welcome to another episode of Three Men and a War Game. I'm Paul, also known as Gristle McThornbody. And yeah, I play lots of Wild West Exodus.
I'm Shop, play Malifaux.
I'm Potter, and my rapper name is Reggie Cray.
I like Reggie Cray. I don't know where that comes from, but I like it.
So a random name generator on the internet.
Fair enough. That works for me.
I was prepping for Chops not to trip me up this time.
Yeah, I could steal my one of my old friends. His rapper name was McP Chavez.
I like that. That's pretty damn funny.
Well, it's MCP Shivers, right? McP Chavez.
But oh, I need that on my license plate now.
So yeah, my buddy Quinn Kiesau, if somehow you read that, man, heads up, you had the funniest rapper name ever.
I mean that's right up there with MCP Pants.
Yeah.
That might be my like next D&D character I make.
McP Chavez. Yeah, dude, it's real good.
Oh, I like that. McP Chavez. All right. Well, we're gonna jump right into things. We're gonna skip some of the early on BS.
This is a continuation of our what makes a good war game, and really just us gushing about why we like the games we like in terms of the rules in those games.
That's right. And for a lot of them, so far what we talked about last time, it really came down to their game engines. You know, yep. What makes them tick.
So let's get right into it and talk about. So we talk about resource management as a thing. And so for me, there's three pillars in wargaming, and those three pillars are activation style, resource management, and what we're about to talk about, and that's objective based gameplay. Because throwing a bunch of like plastic soldiers on a table and then just having them smash together is boring.
There needs to be a reason. Warhammer.
Unless you're playing a shooting army and there's no terrain, then it's fun.
No, then it's especially not fun.
Yeah, that just sounds awful. Me.
So what we need to talk about now is objective-based gameplay, and I am going to go off when it's my turn to talk about my game, so I'm going to let you guys go first here.
Okay. Can I go first?
You can go first.
Yeah, go for it.
I think Malifaux has some of the best objective-based...
You motherfucker! Hey, well, tell me why, Potter. Tell me why Malifaux has some of the best objective-based gameplay. Let's hear it.
Hold on.
God.
I am nowhere near as qualified to speak about it as you are, Chops, because I haven't played Malifaux in like 2 years. But I actually do. I actually will agree with you. I am legitimately being serious. I do think that Malifaux has some of the best objective-based missions out there in the gaming systems right now. Because of the fact that not only are you playing towards... there's so many of them. You have so many different objectives that you're playing towards. You've got your strats, you got your schemes. It's not one dynamic. It's you know, three, four, or five levels of dynamicness within those
objectives.
Let's
get into it.
Steal your thunder anymore.
Let's get into it. Let's get into why Malifaux is the best in the business, and it is the best in the business. So
you'll probably hear from Chris and I again in about an hour. Go ahead,
in terms of objective-based gameplay.
Guys, this is the whole episode.
Give me some room. Anyway, objective-based gameplay. So in general, what we're talking about is what we're fighting over, right? So a traditional game like 40K or AOS, there will be like areas on the board that you have to sit on and camp. And that's like what your objective is. And you might score points for killing units or whatever. And that's great. It works for those games. It's really good. So what separates Malifaux from most games is what's called the strategies and schemes system. So... when you're playing Malifaux, in general, depending on the strats and schemes you're playing in, because there are multiple versions of these, there are 4 strategies and 17 schemes. That's right, 17 schemes. So the way that these work is that you flip cards at the beginning of the game. We talked about Malifaux earlier, and Malifaux is a card-based game, so there's going to be four suits, all your standard poker cards, jokers, etc. So when you're setting up a game of Malifaux, what you're going to do is you're going to first flip a card, and that card is going to tell you what the strategy for the game is. So there are four of them, and they're based on suit. And these are going to be different from one style of play to the other. And what I mean by that is there are, multiple versions of strats and schemes. So you have your book schemes, you have your gaining ground schemes, which are your competitive ones, and they come out with those every year. Now, these standard four things, these strategies, this is the public objective. So in Malifaux, the way you win a game is by scoring more points. In Malifaux 2nd edition, the most points you can score is 10. So you really don't get points necessarily for killing enemy models, although there are some things that you do get rewarded for, and we'll talk about that right now. So when you flip that strategy, it's based on the suit, and that strategy might be kill one or more of your opponent's models during a turn, and you score a point for that. Or it might be that your opponent sets up three pieces of, so it's three markers on their side of the board, and you have to go to their markers and take what are called interact actions on those markers to remove them from the board to get points from them. And these strategies are public objectives. So when you flip a strategy, and that strategy is, say, Reckoning, and Reckoning is the one where you are trying to kill your opponent's models, both players are going toward that goal. Both players can score 4 points from that goal. 1 point per turn after the first. It's a five turn game. So that's strategies. But then, and this goddammit is where this game really shines, is the next two card flips. So you flip two cards, and these determine your schemes. So you look at both the suit and the number of those schemes. So you're going to have 4 suited schemes and 13 standard schemes. So and what happens now is that you have, that's a pool of 4, and then there's one scheme that's always available. So you have 5 schemes. Now the thing about these is that you pick 2 of them. And again, this is the fucking business right here, is that you don't tell your opponent what your 2 schemes are. You note them down privately, and then for the rest of the game, your opponent is trying to guess what schemes you're doing. And these, as you can imagine, there are a lot of them, right? If there are 17 schemes and you draw from 5 of them, the variety of objectives that you might have to do is wild. You might have to get onto your opponent's side of the board and drop these, they're called scheme markers, on their side of the board. Or you might have to note down an enemy model and then kill that model with a specific model in your crew. And again, your opponent now has to guess what you picked based on your crew composition, how you telegraph your moves in the game, and it creates these amazing bluffing situations where you might bluff that you have one of the 5 schemes that you don't as a mask for one of the schemes you're trying to score. And then each of those schemes can be worth potentially 3 points in the game. So you have 2 3-point schemes for a total of 6, and 1 strategy worth 4 that takes you up to 10. And that is the essence of the objective-based gameplay in Malifaux. Have I missed anything?
I have to be honest. I did walk away for a few minutes because I was confident you were just going to be talking.
That's all right. That's okay. I did talk for a while. I want to have some back and forth here because I feel like I just hyped the shit out of this system, and I want to make sure that I adequately described how deep it is, because if you think about your flips, there are thousands of combinations of how you might get a strategy and schemes, and then how you pick those schemes, and then how those strategies and schemes affect how you hire your crew, and just, oh my God, it's so good.
Well, you're right on the variety, right? That's one of the big things about it, is that there's just so goddamn much variety in that game, because you're dealing with so many schemes, you're dealing with so many strategies. And I mean, I don't know that it's possible to play the same game twice.
I mean, you certainly could, but even if you played with the same strategies and schemes, the game might go differently because of previous experience, might inform how you play differently, right? But that's the thing, is like, there's a lot of war games that have four scenarios and that's it. And you can play Malifaux 100 times and never play the same combination of strats and schemes. And since you're playing to your objectives, there is the possibility in Malifaux that you get tabled and win. And yep. I have seen it. I have seen a person lose all their models and still win a game, because in Malifaux, it's more important to us to, you know, like get the objective done than it is to keep your models. And that to me is what makes the game so fascinating.
Yeah, and I think that's where my frustration with Malifaux came in with the strategy and scheme, even though I will agree and I 100% will say, and I will argue the point to anybody, Malifaux has the most in-depth objective-based system out there for any type of game, but it's also a love-hate relationship for me. And as someone that was coming from so many years of playing War Machine super competitively, then transitioning into Malifaux, wrapping my head around the strategies and schemes and playing that way when I can wipe my opponent out and still lose, that was frustrating as hell. Because I could not get the whole, I would always play the strategy. It was the schemes I always neglected, and I'm wiping my opponent off the table and I'm getting my ass kicked at the same time.
I got to tell you, that's part of the learning curve of Malifaux, right? Like part of the learning curve of Malifaux is understanding that, like, you have to, that those growing pains of learning that you have to play to your strats and schemes, and that that's way more important than playing to kill your opponent's models. Now, yep. I will say I have never played a game of Malifaux where there weren't fights, right? Like you are going to lose models. Like, there is no way you're going to play Malifaux and not be involved in a scrap. That is just, the game is set up that way. But the objectives themselves are way more important than the scrapping. Like the scrapping is actually a product of trying to get to the objectives and prevent your opponent from doing theirs, not just for the scrap itself.
Yeah, and you just hinted at a thing why I think Malifaux is so deep in that aspect is, you're playing your objectives, you're playing your strategies, you're playing your schemes, and at the same time, you're playing your opponents.
Yeah, and actually,
that whole
and making
extra
it,
layer there.
Yeah, and making even more in depth than that. Like, one of the masters I play is a Gremlin master called Zip, and Zip's playstyle, like, he's actually designed as a person that only plays to deny the opponent's schemes. Like, that is his playstyle. His playstyle is reliant on the skill of the person playing him to recognize what their opponent has taken and disrupt them from doing it. And, like, just that amount of design space is so mind-blowing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and two, you know, you said you're playing the other person's objectives or their schemes. You don't even necessarily know what they are.
Right. And that goes into that whole, like what you were talking about last episode with the bluffing mechanic from a resource standpoint from Malifaux. Not only are you bluffing from your cards and whether you're going to cheat, but now you're bluffing with
your also bluffing schemes. Yeah, for
yeah,
sure.
Yeah, because if you know X schemes are in the pool, you can go, well, I picked these two, but I'm going to act like I'm going for this scheme and completely screw up your opponent.
Right. And we can talk about now one of the great bluffs in Malifaux. And so there's a scheme in Malifaux that's now gone by many names and has allowed you to score by many ways. But essentially the essence of this scheme is that you pick a model on your squad privately and you nominate that model to be what's called a sucker. And then what you're trying to do is force your opponent's master or henchman models to kill that sucker model. And if they kill that model with a master or a henchman, you score points. And the beauty of this scheme is that you can take a big ass model and jam it down your opponent's throat if that's in the scheme pool, even if you don't take it. Because even if you didn't take it, they're like, oh shit, he's running that huge model right at my master. That guy's the sucker. If I kill it, I'm going to give my opponent 3 points, even though you might not have even taken the scheme. So it's like bluffing and double bluffing is so good.
Well, and you're talking about that one. One of my favorites all the time before they changed it, but, you know, back in the early onsets of second edition Malifaux was Bodyguard. And it, as a Lynch player, I absolutely loved doing that because I would throw Bodyguard on Huggy. I would get Huggy buried, and then I would just go at the very end of the game. I would go blow something up with whatchamacallit, Brilliance on it, and boom, Huggy's
and
back.
Then pop and then the Hovering Darkness out, and then score Bodyguard. Yeah, for sure.
I love doing
that. Let me tell you about my favorite combination ever, which was, kill the sucker and deliver a message as two schemes.
So you delivered a message, and he was pissed, and then he killed you, and then you scored 3 points, and he was more pissed.
I did it even trickier than that, Chops.
Okay. So good.
Because deliver a message, you needed, I believe it was 2 AP. To get that done. So you couldn't do it if you walked up to the master. So the master had a chance to kill you. So what I would do is nominate a Krulligan as a sucker, right? Who can deploy basically anywhere on the board. Have them do their drop a scheme marker, leap over into melee with the master. And the master's like, what the fuck? Stab. Kill him. Okay, I just got 3 points. Out pops Bete Noir.
And then Bete Noir activates and delivers the message. And then possibly kills everything in the opponent's back line on the next turn.
Oh my god.
Yeah, it was like the perfect combination where I had full points from both schemes by the end of turn one.
Yeah, that's really good. If you had but your opponent really, man, if you rushed a Krulligan and you had Bete Noir sitting off the board and they killed that Krulligan, they signed their own death warrant. I would have let that Krulligan beat on me all day.
I still remember the very first time Paul pulled that Bete Noir tactic on me. I hate Nicodem so much.
Oh, he's dead now.
But again, this just gets
I know, he's dead.
But that's it. That's Malifaux objective-based gameplay. It's the best. You guys can talk about whatever other game you want, but I love Malifaux.
So I will go in there. I will say Star Wars Legion for me has got a really good standpoint of an objective-based game. To me, it falls in the same line of Malifaux. I feel as the game goes on, as they start putting more and more of these terrain packs out with the new missions in it, you're going to get to the point where it's going to be like Malifaux. Playing the same game, you just won't play the same game multiple times in a row because there's going to be so many different ways to do combos in terms of your objectives, in terms of your deployments, in terms of your weather conditions. It's going to change that up, and it's going to be a good, lively game. It's going to keep the game being fresh for a very long time coming.
Yeah, and I'll say this about Legion. For our listeners that don't play Legion, it's very hard to use audio only to describe the way that you select your objective in Star Wars Legion, other than to say that you make a grid and then the players can selectively remove cards that they don't want from the grid. And then the cards that you're left with in the leftmost position are what you use. So you might end up with that. You basically have three different weather conditions, three different deployment styles, and three different objectives. And depending on what gets picked up is what the objective you take is. And that can really make for some very interesting tactical decisions right at the beginning, but also a large variance in what objective you might go for. And just to speak to the objectives themselves, they are quite good for a squad-based game. They aren't like all as simple as just like hold a spot. They're often like you need to grab a supply box and then like run away and defend it, right? Like they're really good.
Yeah, and so and again, they've just increased the last two months ago they put in the Tatooine moisture evaporators from a terrain pack that came with more missions, more weather, more deployments. You're talking about from the tactical standpoint, like if I'm a Rebel player and I'm going to go against a playing a ranged Imperial army where I feel like imps have more of that superior firepower, I may want to go in there and make sure that I get the the cloudy weather, I don't remember what it's called, but it's the one where it decreases your range each in turn 1 and then turn 2, it gets a little bit better. And by turn 3, you can go to full max range for your shooting. So that could be right there where a tactic you go and choose that weather condition so that way you're not getting shot off the board turn 1.
Yep, for sure. Yeah, and I'll agree with you that that I think Star Wars Legion is one of the best games out there in terms of like the objectives and the style of play.
Yeah, and it's only going to get better as time goes on.
Well, and that's really the important thing, that they keep putting those out.
What about you, Paul?
So for me, I wanted to bring up my darling game of Wild West Exodus, right? I don't think. Wild West Exodus isn't as extensive as either Legion or Malifaux, because those games both just do it super well. And Wild West Exodus, I think, is designed to be more on tactical decision-making than the objectives. However, I think they've done a really good job of still making the objectives important to the game. With decent variety and forcing you to have to interact with your opponent. Malifaux, you have a lot of the, okay, well, I need to put a condition on this model or stab this model, or multiple ways of interacting with them. So you're in a situation where you do have to acknowledge that your opponent's on the board and mess with them in one way or another. But Wild West Exodus does that pretty solidly for a limited amount of objectives in the core rulebook at this point. There's the one that I see fairly often is the one where you're looking for treasure. So you end up with 6 markers on the board that you randomly put out, and somebody who is base to base with it you roll a dice, and if it's even, it's a treasure marker. If it's not, it just comes off the board. So you have no idea which one of those objectives are going to be the important ones. Which is really neat. And so you're going to end up with 3 that are treasure markers by the end of the game. And depending on how quickly you get to them and decide what's what, it depends on how quickly you start scoring. And if you discover the treasure marker, you get 2 points for it, but then you can still control it by the, at the end of different turns. So it makes it really fascinating. There's another one that I really like, because it's basically hold your objective, but there's 4 objectives on the board. 2 are at your deployment zone. The other 2 are at the opponent's deployment zone. And you get 1 point at the end of turn for controlling yours, and you get 2 for controlling your enemy. So it encourages you to play both defense and offense. So you don't want to leave everybody behind. I guess you can, but then, you're running into issues with that. So there's all different kinds of ways that they're forcing you to combat each other, right? It's a little more, like you talked Malifaux, where maybe combat isn't as important, but it's a Wild West game, right? Combat's going to be important. You want those shootouts. You want to fit that theme, but it still makes you have to go out and interact with your opponent and fight with them. So they do a really solid job.
Yeah. And I think we'd be a little silly not to mention the flip side of this coin with objective-based gameplay too, because we've been talking about all these games where there's like lots of scenarios, and I wanted it. You mentioned something that was it stood out to me, where you said that the thing about Malifaux is that the strats and schemes sort of force interactions, and I definitely did talk around that, but I think we should also talk about the simplicity of Guild Ball for a second, because Guild Ball is a single scenario game, but because of the way that scenario is designed, and that's to score 12 points either by getting 4-point goals or 2-point takeouts, it based on the way that the different factions are laid out, or the different teams are laid out, it forces the interactions. It's a game that like requires you to interact with the other team because of that one simple scenario.
Yep. I mean, you're not going to play the game exactly the same way you are going against engineers, against fishermen, against butchers. Like, it's going to change every single time because of those interactions of those teams and how your opponent plays the game. You're right.
But yeah, and then the main point though that I'm trying to make is just that the scenario itself forces you to directly engage your opponent. And I think that's a really cool thing about the simplicity of the design of Guild Ball, is that even with the simplicity, they are able to make sure that the game always ends up with some fights and some, you know, wily acrobatics around the outside of the pitch. But yeah, objectives.
So now let me, I want to throw two other games out here objective wise, and we've talked about them a little bit throughout these discussions, but I just kind of want to see where you guys feel about them. And that's 40K and Age of Sigmar.
I like the I like them. I think they're fine. And in these games, right, there's deployment styles, and then once you pick your deployment style, you pick. Oh no, that's not true, right? Because the deployment style in these games is actually dictated by the scenario that you pick.
So it depends. If you're going out of the book, yes, they are dictated by it. For me, what was brilliant for GW was the box sets that they ended up selling, the card packs, where you have your four or five pile of cards, and you have your one of them is your deployment, one of them is your mission, one of them is basically you could get a bonus when you're just playing open play. So if your opponent's got 3,000 points but you've only got 1,000 points, you can get bonuses for being underpointed. With those cards, GW has designed it to where, because you're shuffling them up all the time, it's going to be another thing where it's changing the game every single time. You're not going to have the exact same game every single time you play. And they have it for both systems. They have it for Age of Sigmar, and they have it for 40K. And to me, that was probably one of the best things that GW ever introduced to keep the game.
Yeah, I wouldn't. I've only ever that's why I was a little confused in what I was saying there, because I've never played out of the books. I only use open war cards.
Thank you, open war. That's what they're called.
Open war cards. Yeah, and the open war cards are. You're right, Chris. They are the way to play, because they give you that variety and that little bit of unknowing as you head into your game.
Now again, we're leaving the ITC format from 40K out of this discussion. So we're just talking about the scenarios and rules that GW produces.
That's right. How about you? How about you, Paul? How about you, Paul? Where do you stand with the?
I think they've done some great things. And one of the main reasons why I wanted to bring them up is because GW was never very good at objective-based gameplay, right? Initially, I mean, when you look at 40K, what was the joke? When you have a problem in 40K, what do? You just throw more dice at it.
Pretty much.
And that was it. Like throw dice at your enemy until they were gone. And okay, well, I killed more of your guys, and that was it. You had victory points, and however many points the opponent was worth is what you scored. So it was just about killing things, right? And fantasy and both 40K were that way. So it became very, very standard of what you were going to do. And, you could, because of that, you could end up, making all your poor choices in list building. And that wasn't very fun. You'd be spending 2.5-3 hours playing a game and just feeling bad about yourself. So I think the fact that you end up with objective-based gameplay has made 40K a lot more interesting. Yes, you're still throwing lots of dice at your opponent, hopefully not literally, but it feels like you have a reason for it. And what I really like that they've done in 40K is the Maelstrom of War gameplay, where you're constantly pulling new objectives.
Those are cool. Yeah. Where it changes each turn or whatever.
Yeah.
It helps keep it fresh.
Yeah, and you're getting options, right? You're putting out six objective markers, but they're not all about objective markers, right? It might be, you know, kill an entire unit in almost Wild West Exodus style, you know, kill an entire unit in melee, or, you know, stuff like that, or hold objective one, take and claim objective one. And, you know, so it's constantly changing. So you get that feel, as you should from a company size game, that the battlefield is constantly changing, right? Because you're dealing with a large army. And, you know, if you look at, you know, real wars, part of the challenge is adapting to the changes, right? And you know, people are always fighting over things. You know, so it helps you with that cinematic vision of the game. And you know, that Maelstrom of Warplay is my absolute favorite way to play 40K, because they're constantly changing objectives. You know, so you get that variety, and you never know which one's going to show up, and your opponent's pulling their own as well. Granted, they're not secret like in Malifaux, but they're always changing. So you may have needed to control objectives on your side of the board, but now suddenly you have to get to the opponent's side of the board.
Yeah, and I like that. I think if I ever designed my my dream war game, it would have progressive scoring and changing objectives throughout the game, because that is fascinating.
Yeah, I think it's a great style of play, and I think enjoying that so much from 40K is what allowed me to adapt fairly quickly to the Guts and Glory cards in Wild West Exodus, because it's almost like a mini side of that, but you're also still getting your similar. And like I said, for GW, that's just another one of the good things that they've started doing that they didn't used to do, because let's admit, 5th edition was just terrible with victory points. Or yes. Kill points, or whatever they called it.
Yes, it was.
So that, I mean, that's my thoughts on where GW is with that. I think they've done some cool things. And Age of Sigmar, they have the cool alternate, like, narrative objective games. Like, I know Chris and I have played some that were just an absolute blast. So
yeah,
they're not the 800-pound gorilla in the miniatures room for no reason, right?
Right, exactly. And they've learned recently to adapt and say, okay, other games are doing things well. How can we bring that into our world?
Yep. And I think they've done a good job.
Yep. Yep. So that's why I felt it was important to bring them up in this discussion of the objective-based gameplay.
Yeah, I don't think we can have that discussion without talking about GW. It wouldn't be a fair conversation.
Yeah, and
but now we should have go ahead.
Well, and I was just going to say, just giving them credit where credit's due of adapting and, you know, doing that Bear Grylls of adapt and overcome.
Yeah, I think their new CEO has definitely brought in a new light and a new life to the company, to the games. GW is definitely in a better light, and they're for once listening to their consumer base and seeing why all these other people are going to other games, so that way they can stay the 1800-pound gorilla in the room.
But to move us to a discussion where we can't talk about GW at all, let's talk about another fun aspect of miniatures wargaming, and that's button pushing.
Yeah, this is one that I wanted to throw in here, Chops, because you like throwing that term around, because it's important in a lot of games these days, especially, you know, Malifaux and the other side even. So I wanted to make sure you had the opportunity to talk about it and kind of explain it to listeners, because it is a very different style of being able to score points in a game from just holding objectives.
Yep. So button pushing, it refers to a style of war game that has actions that don't just revolve around taking movement actions, taking attack actions, or like casting spells. And that is to say that you're using what your character could do to interact with the environment around them. And in Malifaux, these are quite literally called interact actions. And the way these manifest is a lot of different ways. And I'll just describe a few of them. And so there's a scheme in the Malifaux 2E book called Plant Explosives. And the way plant explosives works is that you score points if you make it to your opponent's side of the table, and then you take an interact action to drop what's called a scheme marker, which is a 30 millimeter marker, in contact with terrain on your opponent's side of the board. And if you're able to get a certain amount of these in contact with terrain, you can score the points. And it's called pushing buttons, again, right? Because you're taking the action to do something. Like, again, stand on something and push a button. And Malifaux, I think, is the clearest example of a button pusher. But there is also some button pushing in Infinity. There are objectives in Infinity where you have to hold specific spots and push buttons.
Quite literally.
Also pushing buttons. Yep. Yep, quite literally.
Yes.
Yep. And I don't know, are there any other examples that are coming directly to your mind?
The other side is going to have button pushing.
Yeah, other side. I would also say some aspects of some of the scenarios in Wild West Exodus as well, too.
And Star Wars Legion, too, right?
And Star Wars Legion, yep.
Yeah, and I mean, Wild West Exodus, not as much as initially I think of, but as I think of the scenarios... you know, the general scenarios in the book.
Well, the one that you described with the treasure chest, where you go to a treasure chest and then yes. roll a dice, that's pushing
that one's
a button.
Pushing yeah. button. But they also released a bunch of narrative scenarios, and those had a lot more button pushing. I think just about every single one of them did have a scenario or a button pushing aspect.
But the reason I think that it's so important to talk about button pushing, though, is because of what it does for the design space in the miniature game itself. And in Malifaux, it basically has created an entire class of miniatures. And if you're playing Malifaux with people who know, you're going to hear them all refer to a word called a runner or a scheme runner. And a scheme runner is a type of model that's especially good at pushing buttons. Mm-hmm. There's room in the design space for that specific kind of miniature. And that allows for a lot more freedom of design and also creative play, because you have you don't just have your big shooters and your big beaters and your powerful spellcasters. You also have your fast scheme runners that are out there just trying to get your objectives done, but they might be squishy or whatever. So I think that it just enables a whole nother style of play, and a lot more, again, decision making and things like that. So it's just a all around very cool aspect of wargaming. And I think games that have button pushing are in general better for them.
I agree, and I think you undersold Infinity as far as button pushing goes, right? Because there's a lot of things that you might have to do in Infinity as far as interacting with objectives.
Yeah, I wasn't trying to undersell it. It was more just that I don't have enough experience to talk at length about all of the different, like that objective deck that you can buy for Infinity and the different scenarios that are available in there that require you to do things that are pushing buttons on consoles and stuff like that.
Yeah, I just wanted to make sure that any Infinity people listening aren't going, oh my God, no, there's so much more, right?
Yeah, I know there is. It's just, it's outside of my understanding of Infinity.
Yeah, so, you know, an objective or button pushing is interesting because of what it brings to what we talked about last week in tactical decision making. Because as you said, you're spending your ability to do things on interacting with the environment, right? Instead of...
Yeah, to do things that aren't killing other
right.
models.
And I think this goes back to Potter earlier talking about wrapping his head around Malifaux, is that you can get in that trap of... I come from other war games like War Machine or 40K or even Wild West Exodus, and I just want to kill the crap out of my opponent. So why would I bring a scheme runner? What's this guy do, you know?
Yep. And going in and picking a faction like Guild that I played, where they excel at killing a lot of stuff, I got definitely trapped in it, you know, because I started playing Guild pre-Nelly. So, you know, cheap scheme runners in Guild at that point in time didn't exist. They just weren't a mm-hmm. thing.
Yeah,
outside of dogs.
And when you're playing Guild, you're often not going to take button-pushing schemes because your faction's not as good at them.
Yeah, we're solely focused on you know, every time something come up, you know, when Vendetta come up in the pool, you know, Headhunter and things like that. Those were the schemes I was going for and taking those. I even adapted that playstyle even when I played Neverborn, though Neverborn has very good cheap scheme runners. I was playing Lynch and I wanted that, you know, that kind of elite force that's going to put all the brilliance out there and do as much damage as I can. And it was the same kind of thing. I'm taking all the killy schemes and it became predictable for my opponents to counter me.
So what you're saying is that you're almost intentionally staying away from button pushing.
Yes. Unfortunately, I think, you know, hopefully when we start seeing things with more with Malifaux third edition, you know, where we start seeing a lot of the strats and schemes as they release these things going into it, I'm hoping to see a little more of where Guild can stay competitive in a little bit more of those button pushing things where I don't have to take Nelly. But also I want those killy things there because that's what I enjoy.
For sure. I will say, and I think, I'm not going to say it. Never mind. I'm not saying anything about the beta because I don't know what I can or can't say.
Yeah, yeah, well, I don't want to get anybody
in
trouble.
Don't say anything about the beta. That's
I'm not.
Treat it like
say
Fight
anything.
Club.
Yep. There is no blue group. I'm not saying shit. But yeah, button pushing good.
Yeah, it definitely makes games better. All right, let's go on to another one that's pretty important. We're going to do more than two this time, guys. This will likely be our last one, though. This one I think is super important, and that is rules clarity, right? Because if you have a game where the rules aren't very clear, it just makes for a miserable time. And let's face it, that was rules unclarity was a hallmark of GW games for a long time. You know, sure. like especially after I stopped playing GW games and you know, into War Machine pretty heavy. You know, you'd sit there and be playing War Machine and you'd have your cards out in front of you with all your easy to follow rules, but the core of the game was so solid and so well written that you never had to look anything up once you kind of knew it. And then you'd look over at the GW guys and they'd be sitting there going, well, how's this work? And flipping and looking for the charts and for everything else that you needed at that point in 40K because it was so wonky. The rules weren't easy to follow or easy to find and weren't on the data cards like they are now. So rules clarity to me is so important. And the first game that I want to talk about as far as rules clarity is actually War Machine. Because like I just said, it was my first game after GW games, so it was kind of a complete and total enlightenment to go from having to flip through a book every other dice roll to knowing how the game functioned. You know, so I think they were really that first company to really nail down the core rule set. You know, where if somebody had an ability, for the most part, you knew how the timing was going to work on it, where it was going to fit in, when it resolved, you know, and it just made War Machine play very, very smooth.
I will agree with that.
Man, part of me thinks I'm missing out by not playing War Machine. I still feel like I've missed something in my wargaming repertoire, but I can't speak to it, and I just have to take your word for it that it's very clear. But in it, knowing that it's the game that sort of ushered in the modern age of miniatures wargaming, and that in most of the games that I play, the rules clarity is sharp and in clear focus, I can definitely see that probably was the game that started to
absolutely
change that.
It really was, and mm-hmm. especially, I mean, granted, I didn't play Mark One. And Potter, I don't know when you came into War Machine, so I don't know if you played Mark 1 or not.
I started playing pre-Apotheosis, okay. So I was very full in. I actually beta tested Hordes before Hordes ever existed.
Oh, cool. All right, so
like Deathjack wasn't a thing.
All right, so that is pretty old school. So I personally can't speak to how it was in first edition. I know there were lots of imbalances, I guess.
there were,
which made for craziness. But that seems to always be the hallmark of a first edition on a game. But yep. I came in. When did I start?
And a lot of it came from, and this is what I feel like Privateer suffers from, and I don't think they've learned their lesson since first edition. It came from model bloat. Because first edition, and in first edition more so than any other edition, because every book that came out, there were so many releases per faction that they were doing. And because it did start off small. I mean, in the first book, you only had, you know, you had two heavies per faction. You had two or three light jacks per faction outside of Kador, of course. You know, and then you had three casters and then three or four infantry units and one or two solos. You know, so the game did start very small. But you know, it definitely, for the reason why I think it did change, like Chop said, I think it ushered in the era. It was the first game that I know of at the time that was designed to be competitive. It was designed to be a tournament game. It wasn't something like GW where it was, hey, this is a fun game, let's add a competitive aspect to it at a later date because people were enjoying it. It was designed to be competitive from the out of the gate.
Yeah, and I think you hit on the crux there. That point you made just now, Potter, is the reason that the rules are so clear, because for a game to be deeply competitive, it must be unambiguous.
Yep, exactly. It has to be that way. And it's like where I feel a lot of the issues that I have with Malifaux as a game right now in the second edition is the same issues that I have with Infinity, because things aren't clear for me that, you know, they're not. And again, this is just a me thing, you know, so like they're
No, it's not. I wasn't going to say anything about Guild Ball or about Malifaux, because rules clarity is Malifaux's weakness. That is the Achilles heel of the game. There are so many things in that game. There are so many like little one-off abilities and wording non-agreements and a lack of a timing chart. Like rules clarity is the weakness of Malifaux. And I will tell you, there are always rules disputes, and it is definitely not one of the strong suits of the game. For as good as it is, it requires that you have someone in the room that deeply understands the game, because there will be rules questions.
Right.
That aren't easily sussed out.
And that's one of the reasons why I walked away from Malifaux, is that I think I've told this story before, so I apologize if you've heard it, but there was a point on Facebook where it was like 5 days in a row where rules questions came up, and every single one of them I sat there and I looked at and said, well, that guy's right, and the person with the complete opposite opinion is also right. So how can this possibly be functioning, right? And to me, the biggest challenge there is that with as second edition has moved on, and especially with the change of Warhammer Fantasy Battles to Age of Sigmar, Malifaux absorbed a lot of the competitive Warhammer Fantasy Battle people. And it kind of changed. It changed the approach of the game from the fan base, from being a more casual tournament to people looking for, you know, the best, most efficient ways to play and win the game. And when you have, you know, rules that conflict with each other, you're not sure how they resolve. It can create a major issue.
Yep, and I without spoiling anything in the beta, they like Weird has put it out on their website that cleaning up wording and rules clarity is one of the main objectives of third edition, and so far I can tell you they've nailed it. I can't say why, other than to say that they, you know, the language has been cleaned up. But like going for rules clarity, they're on like right now. Malifaux second edition isn't like a shining example of clear.
Not to mention the fact that the index in the back of the book sucks too. So when you're looking for rule,
yes,
you know, to find out a rule or to look for something, you do not have an easy way to figure out where it is in the book. And that rule book is not really set up intuitively. And that's part of that is the nature of the game, because you do need to take the time to explain duels and flipping cards and the suits and stuff like that. So I'm not sure how they could better lay it out, and that might be something to look at as you're going through your third edition beta books.
Yeah, and what I'll say to go for third edition for people who are curious is, you can go right now if you're curious about the state of weird miniatures. You can download the book for the other side, or wait, maybe not.
I think it's only
backers that can do that. Soon, dear listeners, you'll be able to read the other side book, and that will give you some indication onto the clarity level of Malifaux Third Edition, because the rules in the other side, let me tell you, are
very clear and ambiguous.
It's very easy. Like, you can read one time through that book and understand exactly how that game
plays. That is true.
But let's go back to rules clarity and talk about something other than War
Machine.
Let's
also look at
Malifaux.
Guild Ball, because and I'm actually going to kind of – we've talked – Chops, you brought up a good point, War Machine, and the fact that it – and this will actually get us through, you know, another one of these topics that we had laid out, which is a focus on competitive gameplay. Right, and you mentioned that War Machine was fairly built with the intention – or maybe it was you, Chris – that it was going to be a competitive – Yep. game, and that it wasn't tacked on, right? And that's the approach right. Guild Ball took. You know, like right from the beginning, correct. This is a competitive game. We want it to be balanced. We want the rules to be clear. We want it to be very apparent how things work. And I honestly think out of all the games out there, Guild Ball nails this the best, especially in the core mechanics.
Yeah, they nailed it. And part of the reason they nailed it, though, is that they rooted the rules in intuitive reality. And I'm not trying to suggest that Guild Ball is a simulation or is like at all realistic, but what I'm trying to say is that when you do something in Malifaux, the way that most people would naturally intuit them is the way they actually work.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the Guild Ball's biggest strength, is that it's when you see something, you're like, oh, of course, that's how it works. Like it everything is very intuitive. And intuitive is just the way I would describe that game.
It really is.
I think so.
And part of that is because they wanted that clarity from the ground up. So this way you could go to a tournament and it's quite clear how things work. And I think they're taking it in even a step further as they're revealing what's coming up for season 4. All of the cards that they have shown have had lots of wording cleanups, so everything reads easier. You don't need to feel like you're speaking a specific wargaming language, right? It almost feels like the words mean almost exactly what they mean in English. Right. So you could pretty much pick up the game. You could pretty much pick up the game and know what everything means without needing to have had years of experience of wargaming. So that clarity and that streamlining, I think, is just going to make Guild Ball even better at this, because they are the best at it.
Yeah. I think I agree with that, as well as also the fact that I think what Guild Ball did as well too is they looked at a lot of the current games and looked at what was working for them, and they designed a game that has so many different aspects of so many different games that are, to me, the best parts of it. Looking at the like a Malifaux perspective with the Yugo, because at the time when Guild Ball first came out, Malifaux was pretty much the only big game on the scene at that time that was doing that. It has since gotten much more popular, in the past 4 years or so since it's been coming out. But then you look at the resource management that Privateer Press is doing with War Machine and Hordes, you know, and taking a lot of those aspects and the combos as well too that you can get in Malifaux as well, and building on top of it, and War Machine that you can build into Guild Ball as well. They took a lot of what was working really well in other games, designed it into their game, built an intuitive thing that feels like it is just a grudge match soccer game. Like when you're playing it, that's how the game plays, is it just a physically violent version of soccer. And it's so well done that, it, like you said, it's if you even know remotely anything about sports, you can figure a lot of these things out. But at the same time, if you're a miniatures gamer and that's all you have things, it's intuitive enough for the miniature games where you're going to be able to do it without knowing how to play soccer.
Oh, yeah. A miniatures gamer is going to pick up Guild Ball, no problem. Yep. Like, I had my henchman, Aaron, up and playing Guild Ball in, like, 10 minutes. Like, there was very, like, I mean, 10 minutes from introducing the anatomy of a card to we were kicking balls off and playing. Like, it's that intuitive.
Yeah, it is. It's nice. Really easy to learn, which is fantastic.
Easy to play, difficult to master.
Yep, that's exactly it. That is exactly it. Again, Potter, let's talk about your game, your favorite game, as far as rules clarity. Yeah.
So Star Wars Legion, man. This is my first interaction with a Fantasy Flight game. I was worried about it. There's been some ambiguity in the game for certain interactions of rules, but I think Fantasy Flight's actually doing a very good job of learning very early on in the onset of it, of making it a living game. I mean, we're not even 1 year, we're not even 6 months maybe into this game, and we've already got a revised rule that just came out, what, a month ago?
Yep.
For the game. So I think, and it's definitely cleared up a lot of different things in terms of timing, when things happen, and more and more as we go through and read the rules, I see that we've done some interpretations on the rules, but in actuality, the rules were actually very clear in terms of like the timing of when certain things happen. And I don't remember what it was when we were streaming your game. There was a question that came up in terms of the timing, and going through and reading those rules, it was very clear. This is how it's done, step by step. And, I think we were just confusing it ourselves, but the rules itself was very clear. So far I've been very happy with the clarity of the rules for Legion. I think Fantasy Flight's done a fantastic job. And again, they're learning very quickly from other companies like Privateer Press right now, War Machine, or Warhammer 40K, Malifaux, making it a living game and addressing those issues on the fly and making sure that we don't have to stick around with something broken for several years before it's ever fixed.
And I can speak to Fantasy Flight's MO, and that's typically it with their games. They're very good about patching their rule books and trying to be as clear and engaged with their community as possible. Like, I bet you any given day, if you went out on the Facebook question or out on the forums or something, Alex Davies would be answering rules questions.
Very nice.
So, yeah, pretty cool stuff there.
Any other games you guys can think of with really smooth rules clarity?
Frostgrave.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Frostgrave has extremely easy to understand rules. That's another game where you can take a single pass to the rule book and be up and going. I guess I should clarify that I only have experience with Ghost Archipelago, but Frostgrave Ghost Archipelago is another game which is extremely easy to grasp. And there's not going to be a whole lot of referencing the rule book, because once you understand the core mechanics, everything in the game is highly intuitive. But I don't have much else to say other than to say Frostgrave's a really good example of clear rules.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Go ahead, Chops.
No, that was it. It's just that it does everything in it, like your character sheet and your special abilities pretty much tell you everything you need to know.
Yeah. I'm hoping to look forward to that will have some clarity will be the Drowned Earth. I'm looking forward to playing that, and I'm looking forward to what the rules hold for that one.
That's a big rule book.
Yeah,
my friend.
Paul's got a lot to teach me.
Yeah,
the rules are very good, though. They're very good. It's just like a 96 page rule book. It's a big one.
Well, it's another Infinity Light.
Yeah, it is. I think it's another game, though, that like while it's 96 pages, it's 96 pages of a lot of examples, and a lot of it is very intuitive.
Yep.
That sounds good.
Once you understand the core mechanics, what nailing it does, you can extrapolate what a nail it is going to do in every attribute scenario.
Right.
So
all right, well,
guys, I have too many war game rules in my brain.
That's why we don't play Infinity. because that would just knock all of that out.
And that's why Paul teaches them all to me wrong.
Yeah, so if you ever play Potter and he does something wrong, it's probably my fault.
Yep.
All right, well, that's going to wrap this section of this discussion up. This is going to be maybe a three-parter, I guess, because we still have some things to talk about.
All right, until next time, then.
So yeah. any last thoughts?
Play Star Wars Legion. It's fun. More people need to play that game.
Despite rules clarity, Malifaux is still better than your game. Play it.
I was waiting for that.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. All right. Well, then I guess I will jump on board with this and say play Wild West Exodus. Rules are clearer than Malifaux, but does have some issues. But, God, like last time I said, the tactical decision-making in that game is fucking brilliant.
Also, let's get another side meta going, guys. Get it. Go buy the other side. It's going to be great. Yes.
We might have ours by the time this is airing or released. So, yeah, this discussion on what makes games great might be interrupted by some other side shenanigans.
Yeah, because I've already got I've got three demos and four full games lined up for the first 2 weeks I have of the game.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah, it's going to consume a lot of my time, I think. So.
Got people who want to play it.
Yep, and the nice thing is the day they come in, we'll be playing them the day they come in.
Yep, don't have to build shit.
Because it's all built. Oh, bitch, yep. Yeah.
Out of the box and the onto the table.
The hobbyist in me fucking, is crying, but the wargamer in fucking, me is happy.
Fucking get some. Yeah, I'm so excited. Yep.
Open it up, unbox it, put it on the table, and start flipping cards.
And man, my gibbering hordes, man. I'm just going to airbrush and wash those.
Hell yeah, that's all I'm going to do.
Paint it.
Yep.
Yeah, lucky.
Yep.
I got uniforms and so much cloth to paint, it's not even funny.
Yeah, I mean, I've got that same faction too, so. But the gibbering hordes, I think, are going to get painted first.
Yeah, you need to let me know what you're painting yours so I don't paint the same colors.
That's fair.
All right, gents.
All right, guys.
Well, Paul.
Patreon.
Paul, plug it away.
Oh, I'm dying. You do it.
Oh, I do it. All right, cool. So find us on social media, 3 Minute War Game. We're on Twitter. We're on Facebook. It's the number three, not the name. We're on Podbean, 3 Minute War Game, at podbean.com or /podbean.com. We're also on Patreon. You can find us there. Thank you to all our patrons that so far that have signed up. We really appreciate it. You guys are helping us make this channel a lot better. And then check us out on Twitch. We'll be streaming our games, trying to get to a set schedule where we're streaming at least every Thursday, maybe every other Monday. So go out and check us out there as well, too.
And thanks to Static as a City for letting us use their music.
Yes, I forgot about that. Thank you, guys. As Paul dies.
Paul's dying.
Dying breath. Thank you, Static City.
Yeah, yeah. All right, I think I'm okay now. Just in time to say goodnight, everybody. Thanks for listening.
Good night. I do love Monster, though. Man.
Oh. I tried that for the first time, like, 2 weeks ago. Man. That was like, I don't know, drinking redneck piss.
That shit's nasty. I'll agree with you. It does, like, I remember when I went snowboarding once as a kid, and it was, like, right when Red Bull was coming out. And they had a, like Red Bulls like in the side of like a hill, right? And they were just like, "Come here, try free Red Bull." And this smart ass kid, I remember he like cruised up and he like took one. I was like, "Cool, free drinks!" And he popped the can. I swear to God, and he popped the can. put a little bit in his mouth. Like, he, like, went up to, like, you know, do a, like, big refreshing, like, commercial gulp. And his eyes fucking widened out. He spit it out. He was like, y'all, this is like frozen dog piss.